Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 133 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. You can join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download us as a podcast. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And now for a wee bit of feedback. Melissa on Facebook wrote, David Crow is the journalist for one of the best podcasts I've been fortunate to come across, The Infectious Myth. Orville, also on Facebook, wrote, recently an Ebola vaccine trial was published with an incredible result. None of the people who were vaccinated came down with Ebola, while quite a few unvaccinated people did. David Crow dissects this trial, and by the time he's finished, there's nothing but a bloody mess left on the floor. Terry Michael runs the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism and was a press secretary for the Democratic National Committee in the 1980s and a press aide for Congressmen Paul Simon and Robert Matsui. He started his career as a journalist in the late 1960s. He describes himself as a libertarian Democrat, and recently he was the senior media advisor for the Johnson-Well libertarian presidential race. As a gay man, Terry once believed the AIDS propaganda that was directed mostly at his community, but once he discovered the work of Christine Maggiore, who was my co-host and founder of the podcast, How Positive Are You?, he started to question everything. And now he's questioning pre-exposure prophylaxis, cutely named PrEP, to distinguish it from post-exposure prophylaxis, cutely named PEP. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thanks, David. You know, today, or actually yesterday, was the 10th anniversary of when I first stumbled onto Descent from the HIV Equals AIDS Paradigm. I just thought of that. It was February 27th of 2007. When I found a story in Reason Online magazine about a Australian straight man carrying a loaded weapon, his HIV positive status. And that led me down the road to start reading Christine Maggiore's website, Help Alive and Well. And that moved me to where I am now as a I guess, outspoken dissenter.
Yes, as Fauci or Gallo would describe you as a, quote, denialist. It seems like the most popular term to diminish somebody who has...
Yes, try to associate someone with the Holocaust and then you shut down the debate. That's the whole purpose of hurling that epithet at us.
Yeah, I'm collecting multiple denialisms. I questioned climate change as an environmentalist for many years, and so that makes me a climate change denialist, and I think I'm an AIDS denialist, and I'm probably a vaccine denialist. And you don't have to go all the way. You just need to start asking questions, and that becomes a big problem. Anyway, before we get into PrEP, I just wanted to briefly talk about politics, since you've been politically connected and you're connected to the media. In a lot of ways. So as a libertarian Democrat, what did you think about the two main presidential candidates in last year's election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, now president?
Well, to put it succinctly, I thought one was a liar and one was a lunatic.
Or could it be both?
Well, I think so, but at least that was alliterative. But yes. Clinton just couldn't tell the truth about anything. And Trump, literally a narcissist bordering on a sociopath. And I certainly could not, as a partisan Democrat, support someone who I thought, and her husband, could never tell the truth about anything. Mm-hmm. And I certainly wasn't going to support a lunatic, a certifiable lunatic for president. So I did the same thing I did actually in 2012. I endorsed Gary Johnson, sort of a man bites dog. Former Democratic press secretary endorses libertarian because basically libertarians are socially liberal, non-interventionist on foreign policy, and free market, which we don't have one of, on economics. So it was not much of a leap for me to support the libertarian ticket. Two former Republican two-term governors elected in Democratic states. They would have been the perfect team to unite the country. But we got division, and looks like we're stuck with it for 4 long years unless he gets impeached or the orange hair dye kills him. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if you've been following the case of Milo Yiannopoulos, but what I found interesting about the case was that, you know, he was invited to speak under the flag of free speech by a lot of conservative right-wing groups, and he could say quite hateful things about black people and women and other things like that. But it was his comments about seeming to suggest that he was in favor, well, it wasn't seeming to suggest, he didn't seem to think pedophilia between a man and a boy of 13 was a big problem. But what I found interesting was how quickly he fell. I mean, he fell within 24 hours. You know, the day before, Milo was untouchable, and right-wing groups everywhere were supporting him no matter what he said, what he did. Nothing could harm him. And then one tape surfaced of him endorsing pedophilia, and he was gone in 24 hours. It wasn't a slow death.
The crazier they are, the harder they fall. I think of them as a male version of Ann Coulter, the loony right-wing say-anything-for-effect TV talking head. In fact, you know, Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham and Miss Kellyanne Conway were called the three blondes of conservatism about 10 or 15 years ago. And to one degree or another, are willing to say anything just to get attention. And that's what Milo was.
He was also blonde. I mean, obviously a bottle blonde, but it seems to go with the territory.
Yeah, I mean, he just basically an attention getter to try to pump up potential book sales and speaking fees. He's a low-life slime, and that's too generous.
Right, the four blondesmen of the apocalypse. One thing I did like that Donald Trump said. Actually, I mean, Donald Trump said a few things that I liked. I have no problem with détente with Russia. I mean, it may at the base have, be based on his economic connections with Russia, but still, I mean, I'd rather have America and Russia talking than dropping bombs on each other or having a proxy war in the Ukraine or Syria. But one thing, he actually did criticize the mainstream medical establishment over vaccines. I mean, have you heard of any other criticisms that he's made of medicine apart from the vaccine issue, which seems to be derived from personal experience?
No, I really haven't. And I don't have any sense of how well educated he is on the subject, or how deeply he feels about the subject. I was a little bit concerned that Robert Kennedy Jr. is allowing himself to be possibly used by Trump, and Trump sort of using Robert Kennedy Jr. It sort of muddles the whole issue base around which this subject can be formed, and politicizes it further with now a confusion about whether it's a right wing or a left wing or no wing position to take with regard to vaccines. And that plays right into the whole question of does any sort of denying of the wisdom of pumping a whole bunch of chemicals into a baby's body, does that make you a denier vaccines. I thought that I thought Rand Paul had a fairly balanced view. He, as a physician, he said, "I'm not opposed to vaccines, but I'm concerned about putting too many vaccines at one time into a baby's body." That's kind of where I am. I think, you know, we're not a third world country where people are dying of the measles or the mumps, or and why are we so focused on these childhood diseases, that both of which I had in the 1950s, I know they lasted about a week. And why do we want to risk the health of a child, of an infant, with putting too many chemicals in their bodies?
I just watched that.
So again, that's about where I am. That's right. About where I am. And I don't know how this is going to play itself out. Because
I mean, it's good to have some, it's good to have some discussion, because the mainstream media is incredibly dogmatic about vaccines. You're just not allowed to talk about problems with vaccines. I was about 2 or so years ago, I remember that the Toronto Star had an article on girls who had suffered health crises after the HPV vaccine. And the newspaper, this was before the complete shutdown of dissent. The newspaper is very careful to say, you know, this is not causative. We don't know for sure that the vaccine did it. It had all of this stuff around it saying, you know, just because, you know, a girl's health crashed 24 hours after taking the HPV vaccine doesn't prove anything. But even that was way too far. That was at the time of the measles so-called epidemic. And the Toronto Star ended up retracting an article for which there was nothing wrong with the article, except that maybe it should have gone further and pointed out that in actual fact, you can't ever know that anything causes anything if you want to be completely pedantic about causation. But
well, yes, as a former newspaper reporter, I know that most of the mainstream media, I mean, we're in the 90 percentile here, are totally illiterate about science. They don't even know the right questions to ask.
Right.
As a result, they are taken in by the scientific community, and they are almost accepting of anything that, quote, scientists say, because they don't even know the right questions to ask them.
They have faith in science, and they believe that a faith-based belief in science is a scientific belief. But a faith-based belief in science is actually a religious belief. And most people in the modern world have a religious, a fervent religious faith in science. And therefore, I mean, it's like going to church and questioning, you know, the New Testament. I mean, did Jesus really inspire these words? Like, you're supposed to have faith, right? You go to church and you believe, and then you leave the church and you leave everything behind, right? But that's faith. Scientific belief is supposed to be questioning everything. And so when there are topics that are shut down from discussion, I know there's something wrong.
Absolutely. Again, that's why this term denier and denialists are used. It's to shut down any discussion by the prevailing demagogues, the keepers of the scientific flame. But it's become very politicized. It's if you're a liberal, you're pro-science. If you're a conservative, you're anti-science. That's one of the things that may be good about naming a left champion, left liberals, late left liberal Robert Kennedy's son, to take a look at the vaccine question, appointed by a, well, not really a conservative, but a darling of many conservatives, to take a look at this question. That's really part of the problem that goes right to the heart of HIV. It's if you're not agreeing with Tony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in his little white lab, long sleeve lab coat, then you are anti-science. You're a denialist.
Yes. And nobody, you know, nobody sort of sees the massive amount of money that goes into these things, whether it's vaccines or drugs for mental illness or drugs for HIV/AIDS. Nobody sees the money as having any impact on what these people do or say or believe. And but since you're talking about vaccines, I mean, PrEP, maybe you can discuss what PrEP is, but it's sort of almost like a vaccine in a sense, or what it's supposed to do, right?
Yes, it's supposed to. It is, the acronym is for pre-exposure to prophylaxis, meaning being a prophylactic to HIV, the mysterious human immunodeficiency virus.
Right.
And it sort of got started back in the middle of the first decade of this century when Anthony Fauci, the director for life, apparently, of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, 32 years now and counting, was 20 years into his job and had had no successes, no cure, no vaccine. So at first he started pumping this idea of testing leading to care. TLC is in
right.
Tender loving care.
Right.
He said, if you get a positive test, don't wait for any CD4 counts. Don't wait for any viral load of crap counts. Just go ahead and take the drugs.
Well, if I can interject, I see this cynically as a necessity for the pharmaceutical industry to create more and more profits every year. They have to expand their market. And so if you start with a drug that's intended for sick people, HIV positive people dying of AIDS, then the obvious next step is to try to give it to people who are not so sick and eventually give it to everybody who's HIV positive. And then I think where you're going to go next is, well, we can still expand our market further by giving it to healthy HIV negative people who have a relationship.
That's exactly what happened. The TLC treatment leading to care was a fairly easy sell because
right.
physicians treating, and I use that in quote air quotes, people who come to them and get positive, meaning reactive, reactions to the antibody test, it was pretty easy for the doctors to sell those patients on beginning the life-saving treatments, as they're ridiculously called.
You mean the treatments that can cause organ failure, like liver failure and kidney failure, those life-saving treatments?
Exactly.
Yes.
And there's no way to know how many people die because the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, don't keep figures on people who die of the drugs, because
yes.
that would be an admission that they are recommending poison to people. So it was easy to sell people on, because people want to believe their doctors, on taking the drugs if they were positive. So they needed a new market, and the new market was created by, and this is the brief history, collusion between Anthony Fauci and Gilead Sciences, the makers of Truvada. So they started doing clinical trials that were confirmation biased, like most clinical trials are, and started with third world people as their subjects in phase three clinical trials beginning in the later part of that first decade of the century. And they found what they intended to find.
Okay, so what do you mean by confirmation bias? Can you
Designing a study so that you get the results that you want. It's what pollsters do all the time for private clients. If I want to prove that we need, let's say, for people who use drugs, treat them as health problems as opposed to incarcerating them. And I want to do a poll that shows where the American people stand on this. I can get whatever results I want from that poll, depending on how I ask the question.
Right, right.
And that's how these clinical trials work. You figure out, you design the study in a way that it cannot fail to reach the decision that you want. And the decision that Tony Fauci and his friend John C. Martin, the CEO of Gilead Sciences of Foster City, California, wanted was, Let's have pre-exposure prophylaxis. Let's have a victory here in the war on AIDS. We've had no victory, so this can be our victory. And that is what's turned out to happen. We have seen Fauci in July of 2012, 10 days before the beginning of the International AIDS Society meeting in Washington, D.C., the first time in the U.S. in 20 years, which Fauci funded with $7 million in federal funds. He holds a press conference to hail the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA's approval of PrEP. This approval came 6 months after Gilead filed for Truvada as a new use for Truvada for this PrEP.
And another benefit.
The only nucleoside analog drug that was given approval by the FDA. That in itself tells you how this was really a collusion between a government bureaucrat and a drug company.
What do you mean? I mean, AZT was approved by the FDA, and that's a nucleoside analog. What did you mean by it's the only nucleoside analog approved? Approved for PrEP?
Approved for PrEP.
Oh, okay. I understand. Yeah, gotcha.
In other words, there are all kinds of nucleoside analogs out there, all kinds of reverse transcriptase inhibitors. But this is the only one that was approved. This trade name drug, which is made up of two drugs that I can never remember the names of.
Amitriptyline and I can't remember them either. But it doesn't really matter. But they're both nucleoside analogs.
Tenofovir disproxil fumarate and emtricitabine. Yeah. Those are the two drugs that are in Truvada. They started out, by the way, in some of these clinical trials of using another Gilead drug, Viriad.
Right.
But Viriad was going to go out of patent in December 2016. And of course, that means they could have made a generic of it. And Truvada, I've read conflicting things. I don't think it goes out of patent control until 2024, but maybe sooner than that. So it was obvious why they wanted to use Truvada, because it had a longer shelf life to rake in $1,000 a month per patient on PrEP. And that's the whole story here. You see all kinds of advertising in gay publications now about how you can protect yourself with PrEP. And if you can't afford the copayment of a couple thousand dollars, Gilead will help you with that copayment. So they set up a nonprofit. They pay the copayment. The person with that copayment hands it to the pharmacist, and it goes right back to Gilead. It is a shell game, and it borders on criminal. It probably is criminal that they are bringing back the very money they're saying they're generously helping people with a copay for, and it's about $1,000 a month.
So
one person and put them on PrEP for 20 years, you've got $240,000 just by reaching one person with PrEP.
Right. I understand. Now, for the listeners' benefit who might not know what nucleoside analogs are, DNA is composed of four bases, abbreviated ACGT, adenosine, cytosine, guanine, thymidine. And a nucleoside analog emulates one of those bases. And what it means is when a molecule of DNA tries to divide, when a strand of DNA tries to divide and replicate, a single molecule of a nucleoside analog stops the process in its tracks. And that's why these drugs are so dangerous.
And the full reference to those drugs are nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, NRTIs. And they were the original monotherapy that began with AZT and was killing people right and left in high doses in the late 80s and early 1990s.
Well, I don't like to call them a reverse transcriptase inhibitor because that, I think, is totally speculative.
I'm using the term that they...
they use, right. But that's like calling it the human immunodeficiency virus, and then everybody says, well, what does it do? Well, it causes human immunodeficiency. It kind of answers your question about
right.
Does it cause this syndrome?
There's that great Willa Cather line, give the people a new word, in this case an acronym, they think they have a new fact.
Right. You said these trials couldn't fail, but actually two of the trials, there were four trials. Can you describe the two that failed
fail in the sense of they couldn't make anybody positive from... there were four trials basically that figured into the Food and Drug Administration's acceptance of Truvada for PrEP. And this was filed, that request for the new use of Truvada was filed in November of 2011. And by July of 2012, it was fast tracked through. Keep in mind, fast tracking would, you would think that means we've got to use this really quickly because people are sick. Well, this was fast tracking of a drug of people who are not only not sick, but not positive. So right. There were basically four studies that were being considered in the time period between about 2008 and 2012 or so. Mm-hmm. Three of these were to heterosexual couples and women. Voice PrEP, Fem PrEP were to female HIV negative
right.
women in Africa, South Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. And in those two trials, they stopped them early because there was no difference between Truvada and the placebo. Zero difference.
Right.
As much as, and they were seeing that happening, and they didn't want to continue to run a trial that it wasn't going to do them any good. That meaning Gilead Sciences. Gilead didn't run the trials. The federal government and the Gates Foundation paid for the trials at the stimulation of Tony Fauci, our friend.
Mm.
So two studies that were just thrown out because they weren't producing the results that the researchers wanted.
I thought for a moment that they stopped the trials because they didn't want to expose people to potentially toxic drugs when it wasn't doing any good. But you're saying that's naive on my part.
They didn't have to worry about that because they were doing this on third world people.
Right.
Keep in mind, all four of the studies, the other two I'm about to describe, were done not in the United States where the FDA would approve it for American use. They were done in third world countries. That's the case with lots and lots of drug clinical trials for lots and lots of diseases. You just go to a third world country and you don't have to live up to the same standards. You don't have to pay the subjects as much as you pay them in the United States. So there were two trials then that were used to by the FDA to approve PrEP. One was IPREX PrEP, and that was mostly male prostitutes. 56% of the subjects were male prostitutes in Peru. There were also Ecuadorians, Brazilians, Thai, and South Africans. And a whopping 9% were from San Francisco and Boston of the total 2,500 subjects in this trial.
Right.
And the other trial was called Partners PrEP. It was serodiscordant heterosexual couples.
So one positive, one negative.
One positive, one negative. And what happened was that they got the results they wanted, and they stopped the trials after they got the results they wanted. The most significant one here is IPREX PrEP because it was on gay or bisexual males. Right. And the claim was of the roughly, 1,250 were placed on Truvada, 1,250 were placed on a placebo. In the Truvada group, there were 36 so-called seroconversions. In the placebo group, there were 64 seroconversions. So with their creative math, they said, well, that means Truvada is 44% more protection than the placebo. That was an outrageous misuse of figures. I always told my students, put a sign over your desk that figures lie and liars figure. Because if you had used the rational way to figure out how much pre-exposure prophylaxis there was, here's how you do it. If you had 36 seroconversions with Truvada, you would divide that by the 1,251 people in that cohort. Right. And if you had 64 on placebo, divide that 64 by the 1,248 people in that cohort. And what you would have ended up with was 97% of the Truvada cohort did not seroconvert, and 95% of the placebo group did not seroconvert. A 2% difference, not a 44% difference. It was figures lying and liars figuring, and that is the information base on which FDA approved this toxic chemotherapy for people who not sick and not positive.
But people say that it's actually 90% effective. So yes, you just said 44%. So how do they get that?
Because they took the whole cohort and took a look at seroconversions. And that included people who were not taking the drug regularly. They tried to monitor that, but the fact is, initial side effects, whether they're upset stomach or diarrhea or headache or whatever they are, would cause some people to stop taking it or take it intermittently. So then they took a subset, a very tiny subset of people who they could, through blood analysis, say took the drug every single day. And that's where they get this 90% plus. If you take it every single day, you'll have a 90% plus chance of not seroconverting. Well, that is not the real world as it exists with PrEP. Because there are people on PrEP right now who, well, I'm going to have sex next week, so I'll take my PrEP today. But I'm not going to be having sex for the next couple weeks after that, so I'll stop taking my PrEP. Again, it's all phony anyway. The protection that you're receiving is not protection from anything real. It's protection from the non-existent human immunodeficiency virus. And therefore, doesn't make any difference, but that's how we get this 90% plus number, and I sometimes see it cited as 99%.
Okay, so they're saying we're protecting you from the antibodies. Of course, the trial didn't follow the people who became positive to see if they got sick down the road.
These trials, keep in mind, again, are 1 to 2 year trials.
Right.
That's why they were able to claim, well, we didn't see many side effects, the drug company euphemism for adverse effects. You didn't see many side effects because it takes a long period of time for your liver and your kidneys and your heart and all kinds of other problems that exist over a long period of time and high dosages. Take a look at people who started taking these drugs back in the 1990s and have been taking them ever since. You're going to see the lipoatrophy, the wasting the face, the lipodystrophy, distended stomachs, thin limbs with protruding veins, chronic diarrhea, then eventually the liver dysfunction and kidney dysfunction and heart attacks. It takes years for the cumulative effect of some of these drugs, but that doesn't mean you're not being hurt.
Yes. Do you know what the placebo was? Did they say in the trial?
Well, no, I think the placebo is nothing but probably cornstarch.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure, because one of the things I've discovered with the vaccine trials is that the placebo is generally another vaccine. So they managed to eliminate adverse effects because you do one of two things. You either, I think in the polio trials, what they did is they took the polio vaccine without the biological component. So it was all the same things like formaldehyde, all this kind of stuff, that would have all been in the placebo. So if there were side effects to the components of the vaccine other than the biological components, those would be the same in both groups. So you could, for example, conceive of creating a you know, a drug which had everything but the active ingredient, and who knows what other things that are in there that could cause side effects.
Yes, I really have never seen that claim that the placebo was not a true placebo, a sugar pill, as it placebos are frequently called. But I certainly wouldn't put anything past them. But I don't think that probably would have been particularly useful to them in these trials. They just wanted to show that people who took something without anything in it would seroconvert. Test positive on the antibody tests, which, as we know, are not tests for virions. They are tests for basically proteins in the antibody that can come from, as we know, scores of different bodily conditions.
This is being heavily promoted, you know, in the academic press, the wonderful results of this trial, the whole bit. It's promoted at the social level, I mean, mostly to gay men. I don't know if there's really any marketing outside of that. But what's the...
I think they're African-Americans. There is
okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very much like the heavy promotion of alcohol and tobacco in minority communities. There is a heavy promotion among African-Americans because the CDC says that if you're African-American, you're male, you're 8 times more likely to become HIV positive than if you're a Caucasian male. And if you're an African-American woman, you are over 20 times more likely to become positive than a Caucasian woman. Now, that means this is a miracle pathogen that's able to tell whether you're white or whether you're black, whether you're gay, right, or whether you're straight. And that is the reason they are able to take this advertising to minority communities, because here's the science. Here are the scientists of the United States government saying that if you're black, you've got to be really careful. You need to take these drugs and you need to get tested.
And this is $12,000 a year.
Yeah, $1,000 a month basically is what Truvada and the other leukocyte analogs cost. I don't know what the protease inhibitors are cost, but I suspect it's the same.
But there's aren't very many people, like, I don't really think there's a big market for, if you went up to somebody and said, look, I got this drug that could prevent you from coming down with AIDS, and it's going to cost you $12,000 a year. Like, if I was uninsured in America, how many people like that would have the $12,000?
I mean, it's easy, again, for people to get the money if you want it, you can get the money, either through your private insurance, mm-hmm, or through ADAP, AIDS drug assistance program, or Medicaid, or if you're old like me, through Medicare. And if you can't afford, as I said, the copay, you have this shell game that not just Gilead, but all kinds of drug companies do this to jack up the price of their extremely expensive drugs. They give you the copay, but it comes right back to you. So I would guess that almost anybody, any 24-year-old gay male who walks into his doctor's office and says, I want PrEP, will get PrEP and will have a way to pay for it.
Right.
Whether it comes out of the federal treasury directly or whether it comes out of their insurance.
Okay, so it's basically free. Do you know anything about the rate of acceptance? How many gay men?
Well, I've seen all kinds of numbers. The AIDS Healthcare Foundation, this kind of group of crazies in Los Angeles, led by Michael Weinstein, has done full-page advertising in gay publications saying that there have not been many people who have accepted this PrEP. But then I've seen numbers recently where something like 65,000 people are on PrEP in the United States. I think it's really hard to know. Again, you have to know, are they these people who are, they experiment with it and stop taking it, or how many prescriptions have been written?
Well, 65,000 people is not very many. Like, if my understanding is that 14% of the American population – is black. So 300 million times 14% is 42 million black people in America. And then if 10% of people in America are gay, that's what the number I've seen, half of them men, that's another 15 million. So we've got like 57 million people who are the target audience, and you got 64,000 taking the drug. It doesn't sound very successful at all, does it?
Well, it's probably around $780 million of PrEP. So they don't need huge numbers to make huge amounts of money.
Yeah, but the problem with drug companies is not that they make a lot of money, but it's like they need to tell their shareholders that we're going to increase our profits by 5% next year.
You cannot. And that's why Gilead's shares have dropped for a couple of reasons. One of them is their $84,000 Harvoni, the so-called
hepatitis C
virus, the new HIV. There is no such thing as a virus causing liver dysfunction that you can call the hepatitis C virus. And they got into some bad PR trouble on that, and they dropped the price, and that has reduced their shares. I don't know how much I saw their 2016 report, which was issued just recently, and they did drop a little bit in revenue. They, about 3 years ago, their share price was about $23 a share. By about a year and a half ago, it had skyrocketed to $120 a share. It's down to about $70 a share. That's still three times what it was 3 years ago. So they're extremely profitable. They, their CEO, John C. Martin, retired this year.
Right.
So they are still a very desirable stock on GILD as their stock symbol. But they are sort of flailing their arms and trying to find some new drugs. So I think they're looking into some cancer drugs. They're looking into some other things. They've been well managed. Their CEO, John C. Martin, was Forbes and Fortune put him in the top 10 list of highest paid CEOs in America for at least the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And so they still make money hand over fist. I think their total revenue for all of their drugs was something like $20 billion in 2016. I may have that wrong, but it is huge.
That sounds about right. And they came out of nowhere. I mean, when AIDS first started.
In fact, if you take a look at all of the big international drug companies, whether they're Bayer, Johnson & Johnson, or GlaxoSmithKline, they're all named after families. This one was named after the balm of Gilead in the Bible.
Right.
And a biblical balm that they were selling.
Is that B-O-M-B?
B-O-M-B.
Balming
your health.
With nukes, yes.
But the important thing to know about them is how politically connected they were and are. You'll recognize the name of the chair of Gilead Sciences until January of 2001.
Rumsfeld. Yes. He brought us.
Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And their big cash cow product at that time, right at the beginning of this century, was not the antivirals. It was Tamiflu, this joke of a drug that's supposed to mitigate the effect of the flu,
right.
The second favorite disease of the CDC, with HIV being first. And they were making tons of money from this worthless flu palliative, which if it had an effect, it wouldn't have an effect unless you took it in the first 48 hours of having the flu.
And when Donald Rumsfeld was in the government, was that when they were stockpiling Tamiflu?
That's correct. Around 2004, 2005, federal government stockpiled millions of units of Tamiflu, both by the U.S. Army and by the Centers for Disease Control.
And what was the justification for that? It was like bird flu or something?
No, it was not a cure for or a way to keep you from getting the flu. It was simply something you squirted up your nose to mitigate the tummy ache or the headache. But again, it wouldn't even work and even according to the clinical trials, unless you took it within 48 hours. And there have been a lot of studies done since that time that it show it is a worthless palliative, and it probably has declined in revenues for them considerably.
My question was, what was the excuse given for stockpiling it? Like, what was the epidemic fear at that time?
Well, again, that's the CDC's the only job it thinks it has is to scare the hell out of us every year and saying you've got to have a flu vaccine or you might die.
Right.
And of course, the fact is nobody dies from the flu. There are people who are elderly and very, very young infants with otherwise weakened immune systems who might get pneumonia. If you take a look at the cause of deaths of the CDC lists, they put the flu and pneumonia together as one category and say that about 60,000 people die a year from the flu and pneumonia. And then you look inside the numbers and you find out that at 2% of those are flu and 98% are pneumonia.
Well, somebody recently told me.
They try to scare you with these scare tactics that you've got to take this, particularly if you're old, or you're going to risk getting pneumonia and dying.
Somebody recently told me, I can't remember who it was, but they said that so-and-so was actually diagnosed with the influenza virus, so then they gave them an antibiotic. And I went, what? Like, flu is a virus, antibiotics are a bacteria. But then I realized that the theory is the flu makes you susceptible to pneumonia bacteria. Therefore, you need the antibiotic because first you got the virus, then you got the bacteria. That's the theory. I don't know.
Course, a lot of pneumonia is from fungal infections. That's what the PCP. It was believed to be a bacterial lung infection, but it turned out to be a fungal lung infection. And antibiotics will not cure a fungal infection.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time left. We've got a few minutes, and I wanted to talk. The reason I'm talking to you, actually, is because the U.S. government, through the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, is working on recommendations for PrEP. So can you describe what's happening there?
Yes, they have. A couple of years ago, I think in 2013, they chimed in and approved the CDC's recommendation that everyone from 15 to 65 should be tested for HIV and all pregnant women. They've now come up with three more studies they want to do to give advice on whether testing should be done in two demographic groups. They're kind of subgroups of that, of those they already approved it for. And the third is, should we recommend pre-exposure prophylaxis drugs? That's the most significant of these three studies. Now, this apparently is going to take a while, a couple of years to look at this. So they have put out online a study proposal, and they're seeking public comments on it through March 22nd. And the link can be probably received by looking up the U.S. preventive.
I can.
Can you put the link up that I'd sent to you?
Yeah, I'll put in a link to the Preventive Services Task Force, specifically on PrEP, and also to your article on PrEP. Okay.
Right. This is an article I wrote about 2.5 years ago exposing the collusion of Fauci with Gilead and how these trials were all rigged to get the results the company wanted.
Mm-hmm. And
Fauci wanted. Fauci really wanted this badly because it was finally, after all these decades, it seemed to be a victory for Tony.
Right. Finally, something's happening. Because, I mean, they've had over 100 HIV vaccine trials, and not a single one of them has worked, which isn't terribly surprising because HIV is diagnosed by antibodies, and a vaccine should be expected to produce antibodies. I guess the theory is you can tell the difference between the antibodies produced by the vaccine and those produced by HIV, but theory hasn't worked out too well. So when these guidelines are developed, is it actually government bureaucrats who do this, or is it like a group of outsiders, you know, doctors and scientists?
Well, in theory, this is an independent organization, which is sort of shepherded by a government agency. I can't remember which the name of the agency. They are supposed to at least have some arm length's distance from the medical bureaucracies at the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA. But they have a track record of being somewhat conservative on advocating testing for things like cervical cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, but not HIV, because in 2013, they said everybody from 15 to 65 should be tested. And that simply reflects the fact, the power of the HIV AIDS industry. So I don't have any great hope that they will not recommend PrEP. I'm almost certain they'll end up
exactly. People refer to American exceptionalism, and I think HIV is in the same category. I mean, the rules that apply to just about everything else don't apply to HIV. I mean, no matter what crazy idea you come up with, it's just going to get supported by everyone. On their website, which is US Preventive Service Task Force.org. It says, created in 1984, the US Preventive Services Task Force is an independent volunteer panel of national experts in prevention and evidence-based medicine. Do you know anything about the financial conflicts of interest of the people who are on this panel working for free?
I think that you're almost certain to get this panel stacked with people who have worked for the drug industry.
If I was a drug company, but I would want my friends on this panel. I mean, if I knew,
absolutely,
if I'm Gilead and I've got the only PrEP drug, which is true. I mean, it's not true that I'm Gilead, but Gilead has the only drug. I would definitely want to encourage some friends you should try to get yourself on this panel because you know so much. You're so smart, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And that's exactly how the whole system of drug approvals is rigged, because the advisory councils on the various classes of drugs are usually like 15 or 20 people. And if you start looking at these people, they've all done some kind of consulting work for the drug industry.
If you take out the people,
this is all well documented by Marcia Angell,
right,
who used to be the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine,
right,
and has written widely on the subject of how the FDA corrupts FDA and mostly the drug companies have corrupted the whole process. They pay for it because the U.S. government decided about 20 years ago that the drug companies needed to foot the bill because they were having the advantage of these efficacy and safety studies, so they should foot the bill. Well, if they're footing the bill, they're also the piper calling the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And it's criminal. And of course, just as it's criminal that the drug companies were able to, into Medicare law and Medicaid law, get a provision saying that they can't negotiate, Medicare cannot negotiate with the drug companies over price.
Right.
There are three big lobbies in Washington, to put a kind of a final word on this from a political standpoint: big war, big banks, and big pharma.
Yes.
Big pharma is the biggest of the three.
Really?
Lobbying organizations on the proverbial K Street, the street that's lined with lobbyists in the U.S. federal government. And all three of those biggies own and operate, both Democrats and Republicans, So, no, there's no way to have a truly independent panel of anything. They're all going to be doing the bidding of the drug companies and doing the bidding of the drug bureaucracy, right, and particularly Tony Fauci. The one last thing I would point out is that people want to go onto the web, look up how much money is spent by the NIH and particularly Fauci's National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases for each category of disease based on deaths from the disease.
Right.
It is enormous difference between HIV and everything else except possibly breast cancer, because that lobby is so strong.
Right.
You take a look at the problem right now of antibiotic resistant
bacteria. Right.
And we're spending almost nothing on that problem compared to HIV. I looked up
it's kind of like terrorism, right? Like, the you know, since, yeah, apart with the exception of 9/11, you know, terrorism kills a very, very small number of Americans every year, and yet
the greatest terrorist is sex equals death. That is the motive, right, force behind HIV/AIDS.
But both cars and guns kill about 30,000 people a year, and there's nowhere near the attention given to those problems.
If you look at CDC's health numbers for 2014, it was something like 6 or 7,000 people died from HIV-related AIDS. Which, now, that sounds like a strange thing to say, but they differentiated between dying with AIDS through clinical markers, maybe 12,000 people, but dying with HIV-related causes was about 6 or 7,000. Now, think about that. 6 or 7,000 people are now allegedly dying each year with AIDS. And we have a epidemic in America, do we?
Yeah, that's not one of the leading causes of death by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, we have run out of time. So I really thank you today for walking us through the whole prep scenario, and hopefully this will educate people. And as you said, it's Black people, men and women, and gay men who are the targets for this. So there's a lot of those people out there. If you know some of them, get them to listen to this show and get them to read some of the documents that I'll link to from the podcast page.
Yeah, get them to challenge authority.
Yes, yes. Thanks very much, Terry. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks, David.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 133 of The Infectious Myth. Until next week, goodbye.